This is OBG Project's Grand Rounds Live, a podcast of the OBG Project's monthly webinar featuring cutting-edge OB and GYN topics. Our Grand Rounds Live webinar is free for OBG First members. With an OBG First membership, you have access to the webinar slides, handouts, and future Grand Rounds Live webinars. To learn more about membership and other perks of an OBG First membership, go to obgproject.com/get first. Enjoy the webinar.
Name, don't get stuck with it. Shoulder dystocia tips and tricks. I want to share with you a story to begin. In residency, one of my very favorite attendings and I had just gotten out of a delivery complicated by shoulder dystocia. This woman had the equanimity to handle anything. She was always calm, always seemed to roll with things, never seemed to worry. And we got out of this delivery back onto the main labor deck, and she turned to me and said, "I want you to understand that when the head comes out and the shoulder doesn't, I always want to throw up a blue towel and tell everybody I'm going on coffee break." And I think we've all probably felt that way. But as you know, you can't really do that. That's not the right time to walk away from our patients. So, I have no disclosures to offer. I don't get any monies from any simulation company or any other entity involved in shoulder dystocia management. And I won't be discussing any off-label or any on-label utilization of medications in this presentation. My goal only is to share with you what I know and hopefully get each of you to talk about your experiences as well. Our objectives are pretty straightforward. We'll talk about the classic algorithms to manage shoulder dystocia. If you came through residency in the dark ages like I did, you may have one particular set of techniques, and those techniques have evolved somewhat over the last several years. Though, interestingly, a lot of the adaptations are things that were published in the late 19th century. Just took a while for them to catch on. We'll talk about how those emerging techniques or old techniques augment our classic approaches. We'll talk about the steps of the posterior sling technique and the shrug technique, which you may or may not have learned in residency. And then we'll finish up talking about the role of simulation, both the patient and team benefits of simulation, and some low and high fidelity options for simulation, just in case you're one of those people who thinks simulation is just for the great big centers. Simulation is for everybody. So let's talk about some background on shoulder dystocia. We covered a little bit of background in the introductory slides, which was terrific. But here's why we care so much about this. The incidence of shoulder dystocia has increased dramatically. In fact, in one study at a single institution, the incidence increased tenfold just in the 24-year period from 1979 to 2003. Part of the issue with shoulder dystocia is that, as you know, there's no way to accurately predict. Just as we try to predict cephalopelvic disproportion in general, there is limited data on looking at the bisacromial diameter, that shoulder-to-shoulder diameter, and figure out accurately which kiddos are going to fit and which kiddos aren't. The classic approaches for eliminating the risk of CPD, both in terms of measuring clinical pelvimetry, and even when we did x-rays of the pelvis, we used to get coronal shots of the pelvis before delivery to measure the inlet and the outlet and see if we could figure out what heads were going to fit. And now we've evolved into looking at estimated fetal weight. Well, none of those things really work, either for CPD or for shoulder dystocia, because really the overlapping sutures and the manipulation of the bisacromial diameter both help fetuses deliver without complication much of the time. So we don't have a great way to figure out which kiddos are going to get stuck. But luckily, the classic stepwise approach has evolved somewhat, as I mentioned, and we'll talk about some of those maneuvers and adaptations. And again, simulation has offered a fantastic opportunity for us to practice our maneuvers and, more importantly, practice the communication and team skills that help us manage emergencies like this with patient care at the forefront rather than having our own panic sort of take over with what we're doing. Now, I just used the word panic, but I want to tell you as well, one of my favorite things to tell the medical students and the residents is, if you know what you're going to do, there's no emergency, right? There's no such thing as an emergency. As long as you have some kind of algorithm in your head for how you're going to handle it, it's not an emergency then. Then it's just your algorithm. It's just going through stepwise, maybe a little more efficiently than you would have otherwise. But it becomes very easy to work your way through what would have been an emergency when you have a good armamentarium of tools. Low and high fidelity simulation, as I mentioned, is probably the biggest growing adjunct to our field, I imagine. And we'll talk about some of those approaches as well, because it's really available to everyone now and can help you save a baby's life. One of the difficulties in defining shoulder dystocia and studying it is that the definition itself is so highly variable. The most common definition in the literature is actually different from the ACOG and RCOG definitions, and that is a 60-second interval from the head to the anterior shoulder, or if you like acronyms like every single OBGYN does, the head-to-body delivery interval, or HBDI, which you may see on some of these slides. ACOG and RCOG define this a little more liberally, with failure to deliver the anterior shoulder with gentle traction. And in a minute, we'll talk a little bit about the forces of physics and the roles of forces of physics in delivering the anterior shoulder. Let's talk for a moment about the anatomy. Like we talked about, delivery of the head is accommodated by the fetus by overlapping sutures and molding. But the bisacromial diameter is a solid bony diameter across the collarbones to the widest point of the shoulders. And really the only thing you can manipulate about a bisacromial diameter is the folding in of one shoulder or the other, which does reduce the diameter, but it's a pretty, it's not a bony diameter that can mold to the pelvis. It's one that we have to manipulate physically to effect delivery. The average bisacromial diameter for a fetus is 12 to 15 centimeters, and the average pelvic inlet is 12 to 13 centimeters. So right out of the gate, we're facing an improbable event for the bisacromial diameter to pass through the pelvis, and yet we see it happen every single day. I think this is probably a huge part of why 50% of shoulder dystocias happen in fetuses greater than 4,000 grams, but 50% happen in very normal weight fetuses. And as I'm sure all of you have seen, it can even happen with premature infants, particularly if there's a lot of maternal tissue dystocia. So shoulder dystocia becomes a cloudier event when you consider things like soft tissue intervention and fetal positioning and a lot of things that are less directly related to that bisacromial diameter. But the maneuvers to effect delivery remain the same. As you know, the morbidities of shoulder dystocia are tremendous. About 11% of moms will have a hemorrhage after a shoulder dystocia. That was one of your trivia questions at the beginning. About 4% will end up with a fourth degree laceration, even if you have cut an episiotomy. The extension rate is quite high. And the neonatal complications are huge as well. 10 to 20% will have a significant Erb's palsy, though the vast majority recover by 1 year. About 50% won't have any birth trauma. So if you're a glass half full person, then we do have half of the fetuses emerging without long-term neonatal complications. Fracture is also a significant injury that is encountered, both clavicular fracture and humeral fracture. Luckily, hypoxemic ischemic encephalopathy is not so common. That occurs in about 1 in 10,000 shoulder dystocias because the arterial pH drops by about 0.011 per minute as you look at that head-to-body delivery interval. So we'll talk in a moment about this, but the head-to-body delivery interval and the arterial pH drop is not the only factor in the compromise of a fetus at delivery. Death occurs in 0.08 to 1% of these fetuses, and the NDD, again, since we love our acronyms so much, are non-diabetic and diabetic. So the death rate for diabetic fetuses who are entrapped with a shoulder dystocia is significantly higher than the death rate for non-diabetic fetuses. And if you think about it, that makes a whole lot of sense. In diabetes, we know that the weight distribution is markedly different in a fetus and that they have more truncal obesity and more truncal weight gain. So it makes sense that it would be a truly larger shoulder and body issue than it is for a non-diabetic fetus who, you know, traditionally the head is going to be the largest delivering part of the fetus. So it's going to be a lot easier for the head to come out. Maybe the shoulder gets a little bit stuck, but the head circumference to abdominal circumference ratios tend to not be as big an issue. The vast majority of fetuses that do die from shoulder dystocia actually are delivered within 5 minutes. And this is where the other effects really come into play. While the arterial gas doesn't drop as markedly as sometimes we think it does, there's a huge underlying component of injury to the fetus. There's vagal compression from compression of the head and shoulders and vagus nerve stimulation. There's head and neck compression, possibly involving the cord, particularly if there's a nuchal cord. But more importantly, it's been proposed, and it certainly has been difficult to prove, that the thoracic pressure of that shoulder entrapment affects the ventricular filling. So even if the blood is reasonably oxygenated, there's not enough circulation happening. So most of the fetuses that are delivered after significant shoulder dystocia are quite hypovolemic. One of the pearls that I'll share with you is there's been an argument made that these fetuses are actually going to do better, or neonates are going to do better, if we can do delayed cord clamping even after shoulder dystocia, if we have some sign of the fetus responding to delivery. So if you get a neonate that then gives you a little bit of a cry and maybe grabs your finger and shows a little bit of tone, you may have some benefit to getting that additional volume from delayed cord clamping. Certainly if a neonate that is markedly depressed is not going to be a candidate for that. But this is why, as we start talking about the maneuvers, giving you a little spoiler alert, this is why Zavanelli maneuvers may be so effective, or replacement maneuvers, because when the fetus is replaced into the uterus, the placenta takes back over. And you all know that placenta is going to resuscitate a baby better than any of us can, right? So if we can get the fetus back in without a placental or cord injury, the uterus is going to take care of the rest and really help us out a great deal. But that's pretty far down the line of our maneuvers, as we'll see in a minute. Like we talked about, the prediction efforts are terrible. Labor courses are not predictive. As you know, both rapid or precipitous delivery and prolonged labor are both risk factors for shoulder dystocia. Diabetes is a significant risk factor. One of the underestimated risk factors is gestational weight gain, which is becoming a much bigger focus for all of us. But this is not just in obese gravidas, but really all gravidas with any excessive weight gain are at higher risk of shoulder dystocia and other labor dystocias. Makes sense, right? If pregnancy is an automatic hyperglycemic state where we have more sugar circulating all the time, since fetuses can't digest ketones, it makes sense that if a mama is putting on a little extra weight, there are higher circulating glucose levels, and that fetus is going to experience the same effects as a diabetic offspring would in utero. Maybe to a lesser degree, but that weight distribution is going to be different than what it is for a neonate with a mama, or a fetus with a mama whose blood sugar levels are a little steadier. Operative vaginal delivery is certainly a risk factor for shoulder dystocia. The estimates vary greatly, but probably around 3%. There's one study that showed no difference between forceps and vacuum, possibly a lower rate with forceps, but traditionally, vacuum has been felt to be a higher risk for shoulder dystocia, up to 12% actually, than forceps. And that makes sense as well. When we have direct traction with the forceps and can control the whole head neck unit, we may have better control of averting shoulder dystocia than we do when we're only affecting delivery of the vertex with a vacuum. Don't get me wrong, I'm a huge fan of vacuums, but do think that there's a difference in the degree of control that we have for the head and neck. The single biggest prediction that we have is prior dystocia. So in women with a prior shoulder dystocia, an average of about 10% are going to suffer a subsequent shoulder dystocia. Now the rates vary according to studies from 1 to 17%, but when you average it out, it ends up being a modal rate of about 10%. And prevention is ridiculous. We just don't have a lot of ways to prevent shoulder dystocia. The two biggest ways that we try are induction of labor and cesarean birth, but neither one is really perfect. There are two good randomized controlled trials that I'm aware of looking at induction of labor and prevention of shoulder dystocia. They do show a rate of up to 40% reduction in shoulder dystocia, but there's a lot of concomitant morbidity, right? That's why 39 weeks is term, because early term has significant rates of respiratory distress, unexpected admission to the NICU, hypoglycemia, hypothermia, all of the things that we think about at those 34 to 37 weekers, we've known for the last several years can affect those 37 to 39 weekers as well. So the systematic review evidence is inconclusive as to whether or not shoulder dystocia is significantly reduced in a way that offsets other morbidities by induction of labor prior to 39 weeks. Cesarean birth, similarly, really doesn't bias a whole lot if you look at numbers needed to treat. Like I mentioned before, about 50% of fetuses that are less than 4,000 grams are going to get involved in a shoulder dystocia. So when you look at the numbers for a non-diabetic patient, 3,695 cesarean births would be required to prevent one permanent injury. That's an excess of about $8.7 million. Now, if you want to look at this from a medical legal perspective, that's probably terrific, right? That's one lawsuit. But the patient morbidity, the abnormal placentation, hospital stays, all of the other effects on the hospital system and on the healthcare system at large, including the effects on maternal morbidity from subsequent births, are tremendous and should not be underestimated when we look purely at a dollar amount. In diabetic gravidas, about 440 cesareans are required to avert one shoulder dystocia, about $930,000 for each permanent injury. So again, maybe on paper, this makes a whole lot of sense, but we all know how awful a placenta accreta can be, particularly if it's unexpected or unanticipated at the time of delivery. So we talked about the background. We know a little bit about how much we can't expect it necessarily. So what are we going to do when it happens? Well, classic approaches are probably what all of you have learned in residency. The classic approach to shoulder dystocia was a five-step intervention. McRoberts intervention, which is the flexing of the maternal thighs back towards the shoulders, which resolves about 40 to 50% of shoulder dystocia alone. The anatomy of the McRoberts maneuver, which you are probably familiar with, is that increased flattening of the sacral curve that allows for a 1 to 2 centimeter increase in the essentially the diagonal conjugate, but really the obstetric conjugate for effecting birth. Suprapubic pressure is actually eponymed. We love our eponyms too, right? As a Reuben 1. I didn't actually know this until I started digging deeper into the literature. I thought that was kind of funny. We sure do like to give credit to our past, which is nice. So Reuben 1 maneuver, suprapubic pressure, can reduce about 50 to 95% of shoulder dystocias. And suprapubic pressure, as you know, is the emergence of the fetal head with hopeful restitution, and then pressure typically above the symphysis, downward and inward toward the center line of the fetus to effect delivery of the anterior shoulder. The biggest action to remember for suprapubic pressure in all situations, though, is to get the mama to stop pushing. Put your hand on your shoulder. I want you to feel your bisacromial diameter. Most of us have a little ridge, right, at the insertion of the clavicle right here. And if you have that little ridge right there at your clavicle, why would you want a mama to push and get that little ridge potentially stuck on the pubic symphysis instead of having the shoulder release a little bit from the bone so that you can rotate it and turn it? So that's why you want a mama to stop pushing when you're attempting a Reuben maneuver, so that the shoulder, so the acromion and the clavicle does not get caught on the pubic symphysis. When you add a Reuben 1 to McRoberts maneuver, almost 95% of shoulder dystocias, according to literature, are relieved. Getting beyond that is where we all start to get a little bit more stressed and want to throw up that towel for our coffee break. Classically, the next maneuvers are the rotational maneuvers, which are the Reuben 2 and the Wood maneuver. Reuben 2, in case you're interested in keeping them straight, I think that rotational maneuvers adequately describe, if you can describe what you did, the eponym is a lot less important. But classically, the Reuben 2 is two fingers behind the anterior shoulder, rotating the anterior shoulder toward the fetal midline. And the Wood maneuver is two fingers in front of the posterior shoulder, rotating the posterior shoulder away from the center line of the fetus. There is obstetric folklore that these got reversed in the literature originally and that they may have been the other way around. Now, I haven't looked into this yet, but if you like obstetric folklore, I think that's kind of a fun story. And that's part of why I think that describing what you're doing in your documentation is significantly more important than remembering the appropriate eponym. Once you've passed your boards, I think the eponyms are not quite as critical to remember. Traditionally, the next step involves episiotomy. An episiotomy is probably the easiest step to get rid of in most situations. Remember, shoulder dystocia is a bony problem. Bisacromial diameter stuck between the sacrum and the pubic symphysis, possibly even stuck above the pelvic inlet, right? That's bony. So cutting an episiotomy and relieving the soft tissue is not going to relieve the bony dystocia, where the bones are actually stuck. What episiotomy will buy you, and what most of you have probably experienced, is it'll buy you a little bit more space in order to get your hands in for a rotational maneuver or for the steps that we're going to talk about in a moment. The typical approach to shoulder dystocia involves repeating these steps at least twice, if not three times, before attempting a replacement maneuver. As we talked about a moment ago, a replacement maneuver is typically given the eponym Zavinelli remover, in which the fetal head is rotated to occiput anterior, flexed, and then repositioned back into the uterus. Here's your next significant pearl. If there is a shoulder dystocia encountered, if you can convince yourself not to cut a nuchal cord, it will help you greatly. You significantly reduce the interventions available to you once you've cut off that fetal oxygen supply. If the cord is still intact and the placenta is still intact, you have a replacement option. But once you've disrupted that, once you've switched over to secondary circulation and a fetus is beginning to try to breathe to get oxygen, then those options go away and you're going to find yourself much more temporally limited in terms of how quickly you do need to effect delivery to deliver a viable fetus. So if you do experience a nuchal cord, I recommend that you deliver right through it. If it won't reduce, just keep going. We'll talk about that a little bit more in just a moment. There are several mnemonics out there to help you remember the steps for shoulder dystocia. The first and third, the helper mnemonic and the alarmer mnemonic, are essentially the same as the classic approaches to delivery. The perspire mnemonic is one that begins to introduce some of the more recently recommended interventions for shoulder dystocia. This is just for your quick review. These slides are available to you, but don't get caught up in reading these right now because we're going to talk about the important parts. Revisions to shoulder dystocia techniques involve the classic first two interventions, McRoberts maneuver and the suprapubic maneuver. Rotational interventions may be helpful, but in 2003, a study came out demonstrating a significant reduction in brachial plexus injury and a significantly faster head to delivery time by reducing the, by delivering the posterior arm. And again, if you look back at this, the initial studies of this were all the way back in the 19th century, very late 19th century. So this is not a new technique, but nobody had really looked at it scientifically before. And once we looked at it scientifically, it made a whole lot of sense that delivering that posterior arm is going to reduce the bisacromial diameter. If that arm comes through, then the shoulders are topsy-turvy, right? That's the clinical term for it. And the bone is going to get dislodged from underneath the pubic symphysis because the posterior aspect of that bisacromial diameter is already coming through the perineum, already delivering. So delivering the posterior arm became a widely accepted alternative to rotational maneuvers as your first active intervention after McRoberts and suprapubic pressure. The other techniques that have been identified are the shrug technique and the sling technique. And I want to talk a little bit about those because they may be things that you have not seen or tried before. I was not taught either one of these in residency, and I find them very interesting. I do want to back up for just a moment, though, to delivery of the posterior arm. There is about a 60% chance of the posterior arm being extended along the fetal body. The study's very widely, but there are a lot of fetuses that'll extend that back arm. I don't know about you, but it seems to me every single time I reach for the posterior arm, it's extended. So if that posterior arm is extended, the maneuver that's recommended is to put a little bit of pressure right over the biceps, right on the anterior aspect of the humerus. And by putting that pressure back towards the fetal back, you can effect shortening of the muscle and flexion of that posterior limb, which may make it easier to proceed with delivery of the posterior arm. So once you've applied the pressure to the biceps, fingers track down through across the forearm, grab the fingers, and deliver that posterior arm. Shrug technique is a variant of this, especially if you can't get around to reach the entire arm. The shrug technique involves placing the fingers, index and middle fingers, posterior to the posterior shoulder, inserting the thumb around the humerus so you're forming an OK sign around the shoulders, and then lifting the back shoulder up towards the ear and rotating it forward. And as you rotate forward, the goal is to effect a 180-degree rotation so that the posterior shoulder that you've shrugged up and hopefully at least come close to delivering becomes the anterior shoulder. And because your hand is below the symphysis, the anterior shoulder is below the symphysis, and you can proceed with normal delivery techniques. Now, if neither of those is possible, or if you have not cut an episiotomy and can't get your hand in there, or didn't need an episiotomy but still couldn't get your hand in there, there's also a sling technique. The sling technique is classically described using a red rubber catheter or some other soft device, threading the catheter underneath the axilla of the posterior shoulder and applying traction not just outward, so you're not just delivering the acromion, not just delivering the shoulder, but outward and with a rotation towards the midline again. And the goal again is to have traction on that anterior shoulder that keeps it, sorry, on that posterior shoulder that keeps it distal to the symphysis as the fetus rotates to bringing that shoulder into the anterior position. These techniques, again, were not something that I learned in residency, but they're very, very simple, and they're very simple to practice during simulation so that when you're in a situation where you have to apply them clinically, they're not foreign to you. They're not foreign to your hands. I always tell the residents I like to do all of my cesareans by a Joel Cohen technique, and I do that because in an emergency, I'm going to use a Joel Cohen technique. I'm going to use blunt dissection for everything. For a stat C-section. So I do it for all of my routine deliveries because my hands, I want my hands always to know what I'm gonna do next. The same is true for shoulder dystocia and simulation. By practicing these shrug and sling maneuvers in simulation, your hands know what to do and you feel less like you're fumbling or like something is unfamiliar, something is not motor patterned in your brain before you're trying to practice it in an emergency situation. I promised you a moment ago we would come back to forces of physics, and I want to take just a moment to talk about the mu sub k. I'm sure you all remember the mu sub k, right? No, nobody ever remembers the mu sub k, ever. I've had one resident in 13 years remember the mu sub k from physics. But the mu sub k, for those of you that are nodding and feeling very confident right now because you do remember, that's terrific. But for the rest of us, mu sub k is the coefficient of friction. This is the force that when you try to move your refrigerator across the kitchen floor, you have that initial to get it started before it slides fairly readily across the rest of the floor. Why is this important? Well, for a whole lot of reasons. We just talked about that shoulder dystocia is an increasing risk, particularly in the United States. But traditionally, we have a long-standing practice of checking for a nuchal cord, right? So here's my charge to you. Why would you stop delivery, a delivery of the head, to check for a nuchal cord when the anterior shoulder is going to be the rate-limiting step of effecting successful delivery? The umbilical cord happens to be attached typically to the front of the body, right? Yes, of course, I'm being a smart aleck by saying that. The cord is attached in the front. All fetuses after they deliver are going to do a tuck and roll. So when the fetus flexes the head, neonate flexes the head, they're going to take tension off that cord. I do have one colleague who states that she's had one delivery where she really could not deliver through the cord, that the cord was just too short to deliver through. But for the vast majority of deliveries, we can keep the coefficient of friction lower by going straight to delivery of that anterior shoulder, not stopping. The other part of the mu sub k that's important is if you do have a fetus that you're suspecting is macrosomic, or if you do have a really prolonged labor and you're concerned about shoulder dystocia more than you typically might be, effecting delivery on the first pushing effort of a set is going to give you a greater overcoming of that coefficient of friction than having the uterus not helping you, having the woman give maybe the less powerful push So being able to capture the majority of the forces in that first push to get the anterior shoulder out is going to help you keep from even needing to remember all of these maneuvers. Now we're working in the data-free zone. I've never figured out a way to study this. This is just my theorizing. So please understand, I do not have data measuring the mu sub k on the anterior shoulder, but I do believe in the laws of physics, and I hope that'll help you think about this in a different way too. So let's talk about simulation. I've alluded to it several times, but this is a really important part of this talk. The goals of simulation are multiple. Beyond practicing the skills so that you do have that motor memory of managing the tasks involved in managing shoulder dystocia, there are a number of team skills that are practiced during simulation. And working on your documentation and who's responsible for what kind of documentation is critical. The other element that is really helpful in your practice is the practicing of a debrief. We'll talk more about debriefs in a moment, but this is something that we don't do very well. And as we work more and more towards completely transparent medical care, a debrief is an essential part of building up your team and managing the difficult communications about the things that don't always go so great. Because unfortunately, that happens almost every day to us, right? So task management in simulation just means the motor practice, practicing the skills that you would utilize to manage just the delivery of the anterior shoulder. But even getting the anterior shoulder out involves a significant amount of teamwork, right? Because your first two steps are McRoberts and suprapubic pressure. And you can't do all of those things while you're trying to deliver the fetal head as well. So communicating with your team about bringing the legs back, communicating with your team who needs to apply suprapubic pressure and what direction that pressure needs to go is important. And hopefully having someone who can coach the patient about not pushing for a moment while you're getting that anterior shoulder dislodged, hopefully through suprapubic pressure, is a key element of practicing shoulder dystocia. And it's not something that we really think about. I don't know about you, but team steps and other approaches to communication weren't around when I was in residency. And it always ended up being somewhat chaotic where I felt like I needed, okay, you get legs back. Okay, somebody's suprapubic and nobody's talking to the patient about what's going on and nobody's telling her not to push, or someone is going push, 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 push. And it ends up being far more chaotic than it needs to be. And by honing these team skills, the roles of each team member become clearer and the room can stay considerably calmer even when dealing with an emergency. The other important part that evolves, I told you a moment ago that I don't tend to approach medicine from a medico-legal perspective, but the documentation of any emergency is absolutely critical. And documenting things such as timing of the head delivery, timing of the suprapubic, direction of the restitution so that the pediatrics team knows which shoulder was anterior and undergoing the suprapubic pressure, or if you practice a rotational maneuver, which shoulder was rotated around so that they can really evaluate carefully for things like Erb's palsy, is critical to both the neonatal care and to potential litigation if that should come to pass. Again, we'll talk about debriefing a little bit more in a moment. The data on simulation are unequivocal. Get to up to about an 80% reduction in brachial plexus injury in institutions that practice simulation regularly. About two-thirds of providers also say that they feel more confident. Why does this matter? Well, if you're the practitioner in a shoulder dystocia and you're getting nervous, the patient's going to feel that, and it's going to add to the discomfort in the room. Even little things like maybe push from that shoulder or from that side versus I need you to give suprapubic pressure from the left side of the bed is a very different communication and has a very different effect on the patient and the patient's family. So feeling more confident about these emergencies is a great element of improvement in your practice. In one institution over 7 years, they studied the initiation of recognized shoulder dystocia maneuvers. By introducing a simulation program that was only once a month, They went from 46% to 99% of providers performing at least one recognized maneuver. Now, this was not done in the United States, so I hope that 46% is making your eyebrows rise. But nonetheless, there were a significant number of providers who were not well-versed in shoulder dystocia maneuvers and could not perform at least one recognized maneuver until they'd had a chance to practice. And over the course of those 7 years, they eventually got to zero brachial plexus injuries with documented cases of shoulder dystocia. So simulation works. I want you to be aware of lots of materials that are out there. There is no reason in the world for you to recreate the wheel when it comes to shoulder dystocia. ACOG, AHRQ, Johns Hopkins, the Simulation Alliance, the Joint Educational, oh goodness, I'm blanking on the JTEM again. Here we are with our acronyms. It's not gonna come back to me right now, but regardless, all of these links will take you to websites with a significant number of resources for you. There are lists of materials for simulation. There are videos of the simulations itself. There are scripts for simulation so that you can not even have to write your scenarios, just cut them into pieces and hand them to the people who are participating in the simulation and you're ready to go. There's no reason to make this work intensive or labor intensive when there are so many materials that are out there for you to just go grab. That's what they're there for. The ACOG simulation group works diligently to create lots and lots of materials for you for all kinds of simulation, not just shoulder dystocia. And same with AHRQ. The goal is to improve patient care, not to make money off of all of this. And the models that are out there are really quite terrific. On the right-hand side, you can see just two of the examples. These are the Laerdal and Gomard examples of simulation materials. Now, these go from $500 up to about, oh, I think the big one with all the CPR and all of the cardiac and pulmonary things is like, I'm blanking right now, but it's like $12,000, I believe. So you can spend a fortune on simulation materials, but you can also spend $595. You can see in the top right, there's a pelvic model from Gomard that runs about $600. There's a similar one from Laerdal and from all of the other simulation companies. There are less and less expensive pelvies available for simulation and particularly for shoulder dystocia simulation. The benefits to this are tremendous. Not only could you practice shoulder dystocia, but these can give a little bit more of a realistic feel to hemorrhage simulation and any obstetric maneuver. There are also simulators that involve additional parts that you can put in to practice things like pelvic exams. There are things that you can do for episiotomy and for LEAP and for everything gynecologic and obstetric if you have medical students or residents around who want to participate in simulation. But most of those materials will cost you a fair amount of money. So on the left-hand side, you can see a baby doll and a neoprene sleeve. Why on earth did I put those up there? I'm gonna show you in just a minute. There's no reason in the world that you can't do simulation for shoulder dystocia. When we get to debriefs from simulation, I want you to take a really simple approach to this. When you get to running simulation, I want you to take a really simple approach to this, which have a designated time to it. Now, there are people who do simulation for 15 minutes once a month. That's perfect. There are people who do simulation for an hour once a year or twice a year. That is still better than nothing. But designate your interval and designate your time. We are all busy and we all have a million things to do. But if this becomes an expected part of your practice, that people need to participate in, that they get signed off on, or that they otherwise get credit for, they're going to show up for it. And once it takes hold, people will be invested in the benefits of this. The benefits are so clear and so quickly realized that it becomes very easy for people to participate. The equipment, again, get what you can get. There's no reason to have to recreate the wheel to simulate a lot of these events. When you put together a simulation, be sure you've built in some kind of preview of skills and communication expectations. So running through a quick didactic of what skills may help the providers may help people participate in simulation without feeling more uncomfortable. So particularly learners like residents will want to talk through all of the maneuvers and all the algorithms before they are doing hands-on simulation in front of a group to make them feel a little bit more confident. Communication expectations also play a part in the roles. If you can tell everyone involved in the simulation who's there and what their roles are and make that clear before you start the simulation, it will help. For example, if the simulating provider knows that there is another provider available that might be able to come help them with hands-on, if the nurse knows that there's a charge nurse available who can bring a stool for suprapubic pressure, everyone needs to know who's involved in the simulation, what their roles are, and what they're capable of providing. And if you don't do this beforehand, if you want to kind of see what happens if you run a simulation without a good preview of skills or communication expectations, that's totally fine. It's going to give you a whole lot to debrief, but be wary of spirit breaking, of having people be a little bit less engaged if they haven't had a chance to go into the simulation with a little bit of confidence. The other important role to simulation is having an observer present, someone to take notes, someone who is not involved in the actions, who can keep record of not only the maneuvers tried, but communication things that were effective and communications that may have been a little bit less effective, which will be helpful in the debrief, because even in simulation, shoulder dystocia is enough of an anxietizing event that people may not be as clear in what they said or what they did. I don't know about you, but it's not uncommon these days for me to think that I've said something when it was really in my head, especially in an emergency when I'm trying to keep things really calm. So I have to work diligently to be sure that I've actually communicated clearly what I want to communicate, which often involves some closed loop communication, which is one of the many tools that you can simulate as you're doing this. I want to say a quick word here too about the communication tools that are available. Probably the best known in obstetrics is a team steps approach. There's plenty of information about that, both on the ACOG website and online. But you don't have to use a team steps approach if that doesn't work for you. Just be sure that you have some formalized communication tools for your team so that everybody knows what's expected, what kind of direct communication is allowable, where they need to escalate a conversation if they feel like a conversation has not gone well, and what kind of debriefs might take place to do it even better the next time. Now we're going to talk about debriefing. When you debrief an event, you may know this already, or a simulation, everybody gets a chance to pitch into the recap. So you can designate one person. The observer is a particularly handy person to designate in simulation to tell the story about what happens. And then you'll go around the group, allowing each person to talk about what went right. We always traditionally start with the positive parts of the debrief. The person who's lowest on the totem pole gets to go first. So they get to talk about the things that they feel like went right. And then everyone else, in sequential order, ideally, gets a chance to talk about their impressions of what went right. And then the group is surveyed again, starting again with the person with the lowest amount of power to talk about things that we can do better. This is really absolutely critical. We're providers. Eventually, the buck stops with us. And it is our nature to want to jump in and talk about what we wish had gone differently. But by doing so, the person with the least amount of power may get steamrolled and may not feel like their voice is heard or may not feel like their perceptions are accurate. So if you go in and say, "I can't believe I didn't go straight for that posterior arm. I really wish we'd just done that. Everybody good?" Then the person who notices that there wasn't a stool in the room or we never talked about what direction the suprapubic pressure needed to be effected, that person never gets their voice heard and everybody loses the chance to learn from that. So be sure that you're starting with the person with the least amount of power. So we talked about a lot of things in a very short period of time. That was just about exactly 45 minutes of the incidence of shoulder dystocia, its unpredictability, the evolution to emphasis on delivery of the posterior arm or posterior shoulder via grabbing the hand and delivering posterior arm, putting a little biceps pressure on to flex the posterior arm so that you can get to the hand, or the shoulder shrug and sling techniques. And then we talked a little bit about simulation, how it's going to help your teams, your patients, and your outcomes, and how accessible simulation is. But before we get to questions, I want to demonstrate one quick thing for you. And this is my $15 Amazon model of shoulder dystocia. If you take a look at the slides, here are my references. There are so many resources out there for shoulder dystocia. You'll find plenty of things to look at. But let's turn the camera back to me if we can so that I can show this to you. Okay.
Okay, and your camera's on.
Terrific. So this is Mabel. Mabel came to me in the middle of the night. My 16-year-old was out driving and found Mabel in the middle of the street and wrapped Mabel in a blanket and left her on my doorstep for me. Scared the daylights out of me when I woke up the next day. He was at his father's house at the time, so it wasn't that he was coming home in the morning. Anyway, Mabel has been very useful to me as I've been thinking about simulation and inexpensive simulation. So Mabel was free, but Mabel is also for sale on Amazon for a very small amount of money, or any other retailer of your choice, as are many other small dolls. This is a koozie. It's a koozie with a handle, and it's a koozie with the bottom cut out of it. And Mabel, conveniently, fits perfectly into the koozie so that we can practice our shoulder dystocia maneuvers. You could put a patient or a volunteer on a bed in stirrups with a sheet over her, and she can hold on to the back end of the koozie and the feet of the fetus in order to practice shoulder dystocia for $15 or less. Now, you're not going to be able to practice your rotational maneuvers here, but you can actually practice anterior rotation suprapubic pressure by pushing down on the anterior shoulder, which will help her slide out a little bit. Trying to rotate doesn't work so well because her body is fabric and soft, so she won't rotate inside a neoprene koozie. So that's going to take away those maneuvers, but I just talked to you about some maneuvers that we didn't all learn in residency, and those are the ones that I want to show you here. In this neoprene sleeve, you can get two fingers into the sleeve to get around the posterior arm. Not only that, but you can even see when you look into the neoprene sleeve, which you can't through the handle right there, where my fingers are positioned. But I can get my fingers around the posterior shoulder, forming my OK sign around that posterior arm to shrug this shoulder up and deliver it. See, there's my shoulder. There's my OK sign. Again, I told you I can't practice rotation here, but I can at least practice what that feels like to get my fingers underneath the axilla and get the shoulder delivered. It's also very easy to practice delivery of the posterior arm through the sleeve. Now, is this perfect? Absolutely not. But if you can practice the communication, suprapubic pressure and McRoberts, which doesn't, the fetal model doesn't affect that at all, and the shrug and posterior arm delivery without spending a fortune, that's a pretty useful motor memory thing and a very useful team communication and debrief opportunity. This also works really well for the posterior sling technique. I forgot to bring my shoelace over here, but I typically do this just with a shoelace. So you can lace the practice lacing the shoelace around the posterior shoulder inside the neoprene vagina and pull medially and out to deliver that posterior arm. The problem with the soft body dolls is the sling does break this down a little bit. You can see that her shoulder is getting a little broken down because I've been using her for a while now. So it will wear out over time. But again, if you're talking about $500 or $600 versus $20, it may be worth it to buy more than one plastic baby doll instead of a fancy simulator, just to get started with a simulation program. That is all I brought for you today, and I'm very happy to entertain any questions that you have.
Great. Thank you. And I know that I was particularly blown away by Mabel at the end. That was pretty amazing that you can kind of create such a great low-cost way to kind of introduce the practicing because, you know, I don't think that those are techniques that are as widely known. So can you talk a little bit about that? Just, you know, have you gotten the opportunity to use it? And, you know, how do you find something to use as a sling, you know, in the heat of the moment?
Yeah, so conveniently, I'm going to start with the last question. I'll work my way back up, Ashley. I think that the most recommended material is a red rubber catheter, which theoretically is in your delivery set. So we keep red rubber catheters in all of our delivery rooms to empty the bladder, particularly in the event of shoulder disease. I mean, sorry, in the event of hemorrhage and other things where we need the bladder emptied quickly. It comes in very handy for shoulder dystocia as well. So I'll tell you, if you look in the literature, you'll see a study published from our institution, a case study, which involved denuding a fetal arm from using the sling technique and delivering the whole arm. There was significant soft tissue damage from the sling. It's out there in the literature. I'm not breaking anybody's HIPAA or violating my colleagues' practices. And of course, that's not ideal, but a skin injury that could be grafted and effected delivery is certainly superior to the alternative, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So sling techniques, we do these a lot in simulation. I have never done a sling technique on a live person, I'm very glad to report, because it is a maneuver that requires quite a bit of facility. It's difficult, and that's one of the reasons that I think it's going to be really useful to simulate. Shrug techniques I have utilized before, and frankly, by shrugging up the shoulder, I did not need to rotate. But it hadn't occurred to me that getting my fingers around the axilla was a reasonable thing to do, because I think we all live in fear of brachial plexus injuries. But if you think about it, where's the brachial plexus? It's here. It's anterior. So putting your fingers around underneath the axilla and keeping the head to neck alignment to bring that posterior, well, go the other way, posterior shoulder out is actually shortening this distance. It's not putting traction on the head. It's really taking traction off of the head neck angle. And if you look in the descriptions in the literature, there's also a description of maintaining the head angle as you're delivering that posterior shoulder. I just can't show that while holding my simulation model. But this is definitely not putting traction on the brachial plexus. It's taking traction off. When I had a chance to practice shoulder shrug on a patient, I didn't need rotation. I got my fingers around, posterior shoulder came out, and then the fetus delivered. So it's described with that rotation towards the frontal midline, but I don't know that that's a necessary part of success. I was lucky enough not to need that part.
Great. And, you know, I think just to touch a little bit on simulation, I'm all for simulation. And I think that some of the biggest challenges have been getting participants, particularly with like busy clinical schedules or the invariable unpredictable labor floor. So, what sort of, you know, tips or challenges that you have for our community when it could go from 0 to 60 in literally no time at all?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we did, you know, I talked about setting a time, but setting a time, as you mentioned, is incredibly difficult. So we ended up setting a day for quite some time. So Thursday was simulation day, and we work in essentially 12-hour shifts, both nursing and physicians and PCA support staff. Everyone's basically on a 12-hour shift at our institution. So the rule was simulation has to take place during that 12-hour shift. And if you collect your materials, if you have simulation materials right there on the labor deck, it takes 30 minutes with a really, really good debrief and 15 minutes with a quick debrief to do a simulation. So everybody says, oh, how are we going to find the time? Well, you grab your materials, you hand out your role card so that everybody knows what their role is, and you jump into the room and you do it. And then you come back out to the labor and delivery deck to have a little debrief. Really, 15 minutes is adequate as long as you have your materials. So it's much like all the things that we do in the rest of our lives. If you love to cook, You darn well better have a good grocery list so that you have all your materials there before you start making the meal, or you're not going to get the meal made until 9 p.m. So same thing with simulation. You just got to have all your materials ready and make it an expected part of the culture. Designating a day and designating that it will happen, you know, 2 Thursdays a month or something that is not too onerous in the schedule will also help. And of course, there's the sticky issue of asking people to commit, to be signed off on it a couple of times a year, which didn't end up being a problem for us for most people. And the people who were a little bit more resistant, invariably, it was fear. They were afraid of being in the situation where they had other people observing them and might be evaluating their performance. So really focusing on this as a learning opportunity, not so much a review of people's skills, but an opportunity to talk about the things that we could improve, to go through the algorithms, to, you know, do a little tiny bit of didactic beforehand if people needed it as providers, and talk about the communication and team roles so that they knew what was expected in simulation, alleviated those fears and made it significantly easier. We have a ton of fun. We always end up laughing, but not in the middle of a simulation. We do our best to take that part very seriously, but it's a fantastic team building experience as well. It's brought us all a lot closer.
Yeah. And, you know, I really love that idea of incorporating it into the culture, just making it something that, you know, at some point, I really love that flexibility because you're right. It doesn't always, you know, can't always happen at 9:30 on Thursday, but if you know it happens during that shift, invariably there's some sort of, you know, wiggle room between it.
Exactly.
And I also like love the takeaway points of having everything ready so that you can just quickly roll it all out. You mentioned everyone gets roll cards. Do you have physical roll cards? So everyone, oh wow, okay, great. Can you just talk a little bit more about that and then I'll let you go. But this is just such a great, you know,
Sure.
breakdown of how to implement it.
Vanessa Torbenson, who's a member of I think all of the national simulation committees, is on our faculty and initiated our simulation program. So she wrote a lot of our initial scenarios, and every time we reintroduce a new topic, we often write our own scenarios. But again, ACOG and AHRQ, the resources there include scripting and roles. So you don't even have to write your scenarios. Everything is out there. It's like going to McDonald's. You figure out what you want to order and you just get it. And it's even better for you than the McDonald's, right? So that, yeah, you don't have to create anything. It is all there for the taking. There are also some great resources out there. Meg O'Reilly, who's very big in simulation, she's out in Oregon, has a variety of materials for inexpensive simulation or really low fidelity simulation for a variety of obstetric and gynecologic techniques and approaches as well. So I don't think she has one for shoulder dystocia. This is my own little invention for you. I haven't copyrighted it. Feel free. You just knock yourselves out about it. But there's lots of low cost simulation out there to get a program started.
Okay, well, I guess we'll keep an eye out for the Dow koozie. But I'm branding it.
Love it. My ticket to retirement right there.
Exactly for our low cost, high fidelity simulations for our new techniques. I absolutely love
Yay.
it. But yeah, so I think that is our hour, but thank you so much for taking us through all this. I know that I learned a ton. We are going to put together a handout just so that everyone can reference it. We'll include all the references that you included on your slides, which is great. And hopefully we can you know, all become a little bit more confident in some of these emergency situations.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate OBG so very much, and I was glad to get a chance to be part of the education.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for everyone who tuned in during their lunch hour or for the morning coffee for those on the West Coast. And we'll see you next month.